The Vlada A Dracula Tale sequel, Colleen the Vampire, is now currently running on Kickstarter till September 12th. Please pledge a donation, pick up a copy of this great independent comic book. Several of the artists on the book, including covers and interiors, include Tim Vigil, Matt Slay, Ken Hunt, Chandra Akerblom, Heather Rose, Len Danovich, Jay Kennedy, Nick Capone, and Wendy Shaner. Tim Vigil is best known for Faust, was artist on several other Vlada projects, and Ken Hunt was the interior artist on Vlada A Dracula Tale, where Matt Slay was cover artist, is now doing interiors with Tim Vigil. Please go to the Colleen the Vampire Kickstarter page, pledge a donation, or find it on Vlada A Dracula Tale on Facebook or Twitter. I am the creator, Chris Denmead, and I could use your donation if you want to support independent comics. Thank you.
This is Michael McConaughey. I'm the voice of Vampire Hunter D and a lot of other things. I've been very fortunate in being able to be a whole lot of different people in my career. You are listening to the Vampire Movie Minute Podcast, and you better enjoy it.
Welcome back to the Vampire Movie Minute Podcast, a podcast covering any and all vampire movies that I deem worthy on this show. And tonight, joining us for minutes 10 to 15, we have somebody that knows a little thing about Blade, considering he's written, what do you think, 20 comic books, 25 comic books?
Oh gosh, I probably, at least that.
Okay, between maybe. Like the combined series, including the red, the epilogue to The Blood Hunt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Writer Brian Edward Hill, thank you for coming on the Vampire Movie Minute Podcast. Brian has been on the Radio Horror Show to talk about Blade before, as well as Blood Hunt, which he was in, which he wrote a miniseries for. And then he wrote the red labeled Marvel book, which was kind of cool. How did that do?
I'll be honest, I never know. Chris.
Okay.
I pay precious little attention to the sales figures and all of that, mainly because I'm so busy. Like, I barely have enough time to write everything.
You're writing Black Panther right now, right, too, right?
I'm Ultimate Black Panther. I'm writing that. And doing some screenwriting and some other things. So, generally, my dance card's pretty full, so I don't really pay attention to performance metrics.
How is Black Panther being going for you? Are you on that for the foreseeable future?
Well, I'm on Ultimate for, I guess for the foreseeable future, for sure. I have no idea what the Ultimate intentions are about how long it's going to go and all that stuff.
Well, I'm not reading it issue by issue. I do have the first trade paperback of that, so I will let you know my opinion about that. Black Panther's never been a character I connected to. I thought, in an ensemble with the Avengers, I like him. I think my first exposure to him was a Spider-Man annual crossover from the 90s, where Spider-Man, Iron Man, and Black Panther had a team up to take down Ultron.
Mm.
If you remember that one.
Yeah. I heard that a lot about Black Panther, and I'm familiar with kind of all of the mainstay characters in comics, and I thought I was a bit of an odd choice for Black Panther, but I've kind of found my own way into it.
Do you think comic books today are being written and they're being assigned to people because they want to keep the fandom happy when they have an LGBT comic book, like let's say Green Lantern, Alan Scott, or the upcoming, DC Pride books? It's a lot of gay writers, bisexual and transsexual writers and artists on the book. And with characters like Black Panther, Miles Morales, they tend to put, African-American or people of color on those books these days.
I don't know. I mean, I know that that's like the cause celebre of many a YouTube channel, mm-hmm. right? I think that decisions that go into corporate entertainment
mm-hmm.
are varied and intersecting, and it's never just this thing or that thing,
mm-hmm.
really. So I've personally never felt that like my race was a factor in someone hiring me to do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, there might be some kind of, I suppose, like fan reaction if a non-black writer was writing Black Panther, but I don't even think that would be the dominant fan reaction.
Right, and nobody could complain about a white person writing Black Panther, considering they just revealed that T'Challa in the mainstream Marvel Universe has a white son.
And that's, I think Christopher Priest is writing that, right?
Yes, I
So.
went through at least 10 different posts the other day just because I was bored and I was just so sick and tired of people being angry about dumb shit. You can swear on this podcast, by the way. And I posted the famous GIF of Ben Affleck from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where he goes, "We're talking about fictional characters." And
Well,
going,
look.
FYI, this was written by Christopher Priest, a prominent black writer and a 40-year veteran in the comic book industry, people. Give the guy some credit. He knows what he's talking about and how to write a book.
Well, we have to always remember that the internet is a sliver of a sliver of people that actually experience anything. And within that sliver of a sliver, there is a economy wholly based on complaining. Right? So I just don't take it seriously at
Good.
all. It's just, it's especially now because so many things are in bad faith. You literally have a fiscal incentive to say some inflammatory thing so you can get engagement so then you can then get paid. Right? And when that's the truth of it, people it's independent media is somewhat independent in the sense that, okay, it's not like underwritten by a specific corporation. But it's not really independent when they're still beholden to whatever gives them a revenue stream. So you have a lot of commentators that have built an audience, a fan base based on this, based on that, and they have to feed that fan base because to shift from one direction to another, like if you made a bunch of money complaining about The Last Jedi, then you're going to spend the rest of your time on the internet finding other things to complain about in a similar way, right? Like if you're a critical drinker, you can't change because your entire fan base is built to come to watch you tear down things in a very specific way, right? So we don't really have true independent media because everyone is in fealty to something, unfortunately. Until you have somebody that's just made so much money that they don't care if they lose their fan base from post to post, media is never going to be independent, and that means the conversations are never really going to be objective.
Right. I mean, just look at the, I want to call it controversy, but like the stuff surrounding like the new Superman movie, because people don't like the costume. They call him Diaper Man, because people don't read the comics. Really, Superman's wearing trunks for a long time, people. Things like that, and like the divide of the Snyder fans versus the current fans, and it's just like,
Well,
it's just,
that all makes
it's.
money because if you get on Twitter or X or whatever Air Musk wants to call it, and you say I like something, you'll get no engagement. But if you say, oh, this sucks, or this bothers me, or this is bad, or this is offensive, or this is the thing, then people are going to argue with you, they're going to engage with you, and you're going to get more metrics, right? And so the era of the prosumer culture that we have, where everyone is kind of their own business, everyone's trying to build a fan base, it's there's very little objective analysis. It's all like price point targeted ideology, basically. That's why I just urge people to, I don't know, get offline a little bit, like, and don't let online chatter affect the experience you have with a piece of media. Just have your experience with a piece of media. And then if you want to engage certain things, you can. But like, it's a miserable existence to have to go into everything looking for a litmus test for whatever ideological agenda you think you have to sell to people in 24 hours. Ugh.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. What was your first exposure to Blade as a character and this film?
Ooh, as a character, probably. I mean, I ambiently knew about the Marv Wolfman stuff, but I don't think I'd actually experienced any story until I saw the Norrington film. That was probably the first thing I saw. I mean, I knew there was like a black guy who wanted vampires named Blade, but like, I don't think I like read a thing or even remembered a comic book story until I saw the original Norrington Wesley Snipes movie.
My first exposure was the Rise of the Midnight Suns in the early 90s, where they launched like a Ghost Rider line of comic books with the Darkhold, the Night Stalkers, which was the team that Blade was on for 18 issues till they, you know, they ended the book and he got his own title for 10 issues. Then he pops up out of the blue. I had been a few episodes behind, so I didn't know what was going on. But all of a sudden, on Saturday morning, the Spider-Man animated series, there's an episode called Blade the Vampire Hunter. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, I remember that.
I was blown away. I mean, again, I don't think I'd read much of Blade outside of it, and there wasn't really much to Blade. And this was two years before the movie came out. This episode aired in 1996, by the way. So the movie came out in 98. And I was like, oh my God. And I knew everything about Blade right there. I mean, they went into his origin story. They showed us like Deacon Frost. They didn't name him. They had Whistler in it. He looked different from Christopher Scoffinson. But when Whistler shows up in the movie, you know what I mean? I was like, he's from the Spider-Man animated series. He's never been in the comic books before, which was true because Blade in the comics was raised by a guy named the Jazz Man. So he didn't have Whistler yet. I don't know even know if Whistler became a character in the comics at all yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, a lot of stuff got migrated. I mean, back then, so this was when Marvel was, the IP assets were splintered across a bunch of different companies.
In 98, right? Yeah, they had just filed for bankruptcy in 96.
You know, so you had like the Artisan Entertainment stuff, you had the New Line bit of it, you had this bit of it, right? So it was all sort of different, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes things would get migrated in, sometimes they wouldn't. You know, it was just different. So it was a little cowboy land. You know? So people were like kind of making things, but adding their own things and all that. And then when something worked, sometimes you would see it get migrated into the fiction because like, oh, that worked. We'll do that.
Right. So our 5 minutes begin with Blade saying he's tired of Quint shit and ends with Blade picking up Karen, which is to the Karen character. The female lead of the movie, by the way, this is not a female love interest, which I give this film a lot of credit for. Blade and Karen do not get in bed together in this film. There is no sexual romance at all. There are two people of opposite sex working together. I thought that was brilliant.
Well, it was cool. And, it avoided the kind of cliched gravitational pull.
Correct. And the sex is left for Deacon Frost and Mercury, which is his girlfriend, you see, you know, hanging out with, what's her name
right,
in the first
like,
10
that's
minutes?
That's like Orly Tates is her name or something like that, right?
What was that?
Isn't that actor name? Her name is like Orly Tates or something?
Yes. And she's the one who you see like dancing with our female vampire at the beginning of the movie, played by... Just had it at the tip of her tongue. Tracy Lords.
Tracy Lords, right.
Tracy
yeah,
Lords.
Yeah.
And then she's like Deacon Frost's girlfriend. You know what I mean? And there's like sex obviously happening between those two. You can kind of see that. And Deacon's fucking Blade's mom later on, you find out. Spoiler alert for a movie that's coming up on 30 years old soon. 27 years old this year. So Quint, who we got introduced in the previous 5 minutes, played by Donald Lowe, who's done tons of comic book stuff. You know, he was in Gotham as Harvey Bullock, and he was Ghost Rider's best friend in the Ghost Rider movie. He's done tons of comic book stuff.
He has. He's been around for a long time. But character actors work a lot, and they work consistently.
The police show up after putting out Quint, who's still on fire. Blade is no longer there, and our guy, who I don't think we ever got a name for him. He's just like the hanger, you know, the date for Raquel, who is the name of Tracy Lords' character, who got.
Oh yeah, Kenneth Johnson.
Is that the name of the guy on the floor who got
the? Yeah,
to
that's
live?
Kenny. That's Kenny Johnson. He was Lem in The Shield. Fun fact.
Oh, really? Wow. God, I'm looking at photos of him now. He looks beefier later on, and he was also on Sons of Anarchy, too.
Yeah, he's like a Kurt Sutter guy. He's a longtime Kurt Sutter guy, and I mean, I didn't know who he was in Blade, but like after Blade, he did The Shield, and I was like, wait a minute, I've seen that guy before. I remember rewatching the movie and being like, oh, that's Kenny Johnson in the van.
That's so funny, because in Blade, he just looks like the skinniest little guy, unless it's just the clothes he's wearing just make him look really skinny. You know
I think
I mean?
He probably got like a little build on him.
Okay, all right, yeah, I was gonna say because he just looks scrawny as hell, very young too. So he might have been older than me. I was 18 years old when this movie came out as well. And then we have the montage of Blade moving through the city, like this fast-moving kind of Windy City look to it, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, well, Norrington is a brilliant visualist, right? I mean, if you look at the entire construction of the film, he's brilliant at composition. You know, even, you know, in this little section I'm doing, right, you go from, you know, on the floor level with Blade, you know, he walks away, the cops come in, you get that nice overhead shot, and you see Blade kind of sneak into this doorway, right, or this little hallway. And the film is filled with these great compositions. You know, if you think about this is later on in the movie, but there's that top-down shot of the stairway that the Wachowskis, I think, echoed in The Matrix, right? Mm. There's a lot of aesthetics from Blade that wind up in The Matrix. So Norrington, I think he's a music video guy, commercial guy before he did this. I'm not sure if he did a film before Blade, but Blade is so strong compositionally. It's one of the things that makes the movie incredibly watchable. It's because just the compositions are consistently good, and the editing isn't hurried, but it's definitely focused. So it pushes you through the movie. It's really hard to turn Blade off if you catch it and you start watching it for 5 minutes, because you're going to watch the rest of it.
It's also sad is that, like, Stephen Norrington would do a couple more things after this, but his career dies in 2003 with the disaster film that is The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Well, yeah, you know,
and I mean, his career died, like,
well,
done.
As someone who works in Hollywood, I can tell you that it takes a lot of macrocosmic understanding of your career trajectory to kind of navigate things properly.
Mm-hmm.
And some things feel like opportunities, and then you find out that they're not, but your name is still stuck to it, right? So, like, if you're directing a sprawling movie with Sean Connery, who doesn't really want to be there, and, you know, you're getting inundated with notes and rewrites and subverting yourself consistently, you're probably not going to wind up with a very good movie, but unfortunately, your name's going to be on it because it's a big movie, right? Mm. So, you know, there's a saying that I tell people, and I tell them to remember that some people's money is too expensive.
Right.
And so sometimes you have to look at a potential opportunity, but really analyze it, you know, and make sure that, are you going to have the ability to really manage this and achieve a vision, or are you going to be a component in this big sprawling thing that you don't really control, and if it doesn't work, you're going to get blamed.
And, like, I mean, he had done some great, he'd worked in creature effects for a long time, you know.
That's right,
like Alien 3, Aliens, The Exorcist, The Beginning, which was well after Blade, Hardware, Duran Duran music video, Feast, Hellraiser, Waxworks, The Witches, Gremlins, Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan. And it's just like, you know, he had like four films under his belt. The Last Minute, which I've never heard of, Blade, Death Machine, and then, of course, as I said, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which was the last thing he did as a director. And then he's really not worked since then. I mean, I just hope that he got some back-end good stuff to survive, and you know what I mean? Like, it's always a question that pops up, like, whatever happened to Stephen Norrington? Whatever happened to Stephen Norrington? And
I'm
like, well, I think
I'm sure he's okay. I mean, Norrington is, not to get too inundated with the business of Hollywood, but someone like Stephen Norrington, probably at any point, given the sharpness of a screenplay and the actors involved,
yep,
he could get, like, a $15 million movie up.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Definitely. I think so.
And you can do a lot for a $15 million movie. My guess is he's made a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true.
And he just probably was like, you know, since I can curse on this podcast, he's probably like, fuck this.
Yeah, probably.
Like, you know, I've made money. I can create things. I can work on my own terms. I'm out.
You know, it's like, but it goes back to what we were talking about with, like, Disney and, like, what their decisions are with their MCU. If Kevin Feige just out of the blue announced that the next Blade movie is actually going to still happen and Stephen Norrington's going to direct it and Wesley Snipes is going to come back to play Blade again, it would just make all the money, I think.
Well, you know, look.
And it'd be stunt casting like Robert Downey Jr. playing Doctor Doom, but who cares at this point? You know what I mean? They need a Hail Mary pass to keep this thing going.
Well, you know, things are cyclical, right? So on one hand, they may need a good quarter to keep adult fans of Marvel who are highly critical happy. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of it is, you know, Disney sort of works in generational cycles.
Right.
Right. So if you were like 10 years old when Iron Man came out, you probably have a kid by now. So, like, you might be someone's dad at this point, right? If you were like 15 years old, you're probably somebody's dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Disney is playing the long game, and they think about things on a generational scale, right? So it's not just about keeping the older fans happy. It's about bringing the kids back in, right? Making sure the kids have things they can continue to watch. So in that sense, they're probably fairly safe. Look, until Hollywood figures out how to do anything else besides comic book movies to fill out a slate, you're just going to keep seeing comic book movies.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they don't all fail all at once, everyone's going to still have a brass ring they can chase, right? So, like, you know, the prescription of Marvel's imminent downfall that sometimes you hear, I mean, well, I'm like, well, that's kind of silly. It's not really the case. I mean, you know, hell, if you go back before any of this stuff was happening, you know, like, let's just go back to, like, Superman by Richard Donner. If you look at it from then, there wasn't really much of a gap between, like, major comic book movies, really. You know, you had Superman, Superman 2, like, a little bit of a gap, some cheaper Superman films, 89 Batman hits, and from there, like, every few years, something came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's just that it feels like this is, like, this new sort of thing. It's, like, yeah, it's cohesive, and stories are interconnected, and that's kind of new. But, yeah, I think they'll figure it out. Now, to the point about, like, why not Norrington Boom and do all this, Marvel is basically like the White House at this point. And we can all look at government and say, well, wouldn't it be really easy if you guys just did this? Well, yeah, it would in an objective world where that's how things happened. But, you know, in the world of commerce and politics, you know, you got to get the House of Representatives to agree on a thing. They have to go to the Senate. The Senate has to agree on a thing. They got to send it back to the House. Then they do that. Then you got to give it to the president. Then the president wants a line item veto thing going on right now. And then before you know it, there's no bill. So I think any kind of behemoth structure sort of functions in that way. And while it's you can look at it from the outside and just objectively say, well, yeah, they should just do this. That makes perfect sense. But maybe there's metrics that they know that we don't know, right? I'm always a little hesitant to think that, like, they're just making bad decisions, because I think they have an infinite amount of information, and they're constantly trying to make the most strategic decision based on, you know, an exponential amount of data. And I think sometimes the data can be paralyzing.
We move over to the hospital, and we meet Dr. Karen. Whistler gives her last name, but the IMDb just lists her as Karen, played by Nebushi Wright.
Nebushi Wright, yeah.
I only know her from one film, Dead Presidents. I haven't really kept up with her filmography over the years, but she was in a movie called Dead Presidents. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, it's a Hughes Brothers movie.
Okay. And as well as her... Yeah, a Vietnam vet adjusts to life after the war while trying to support his family, but the chance of a better life may involve crime and bloodshed. It always had a really cool poster. It said Dead Presidents, and then had, like, this person with, like, this white glowy face on the poster.
Yeah, it's a good, like, heist. It's a good dramatic, like, kind of heist movie. You know, back there, maybe Heat started it, I'm not really sure, but there was a spate of heist movies that were happening, right? And then you had, you know, you had, like, kind of like the dominant white cast heist movies, you know, like your Ronins and things like that. And then you also had the more kind of urban targeted movies like Set It Off and Dead Presidents.
Right. Yeah, this had, like, Chris Tucker, Keith David.
Yeah,
you know?
and they were kind of moving in parallel.
Terrence Howard, by the way, speaking of comic books.
So I think it was, you know, it was, but it's good. It's the Hughes Brothers. They directed Menace to Society, they're just very strong filmmakers. It's a cool movie. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend it.
And then there's, we also introduced to Curtis for a limited time, by Tim Gooney. Not somebody I'm familiar with, but I guess he was in John Carpenter's Vampires the same year. This came out in the late summer. Blade came out in the late summer. It was one of those kind of like, what do we do with this movie? Stick it in August. Oh, look, it made all the money. And then John Carpenter's Vampires, I distinctly remember, came out the day before Halloween, 1998.
Yeah, I mean, well, people just kind of fell in and out of cinema for a while, right? You know, and I don't know what happened to that guy. You know, I always thought that, like, I got him confused with Martin Henderson a lot.
Uh-huh.
Because they kind of had the same face.
Right.
Right. And then Scott Speedman came out, and then I got super confused about who was who.
couple years later in Underworld, which is like taking Blade and the Matrix and putting it into one film.
Yeah, Yeah.
The color palette of Blade, because Blade has great color palettes in this, especially the scene where Karen and Curtis are talking. Like, why didn't it ever work with us? You know, they obviously were dating. She broke it off. She told him that we got to keep it professional at the workplace. He's wanting to talk about it at the workplace. It's not appropriate. You know, he's not letting it go. And then she, you know, tells him because you were an asshole. And then, you know, that's it. That's all we get before Quint wakes up and bites her in the neck.
Yeah, well, the first act of Blade is incredibly efficient in terms of its world building, story design, character introductions, right? Like, you come out of Act 1 pretty clear on what's going on in this movie. That section that we're talking about, you know, you're establishing Karen, you're establishing her world, but you're not lingering anywhere. And you're keeping it moving at a clip, but we have all the information we need to sort of take it, take ourselves down the rest of the path of the story. And it's pretty cool because Norrington sort of plays with the normal cinematic ebbs and flows of things. So, Quint comes back a little sooner than we think he might. It's a little more brutal than we think it would be. You combine that with that desaturated, somewhat blue color palette, but you still get like the sanguine color of the blood, you know, all that. It's just a really well constructed piece of like pulp cinema.
And Blade let that happen because he was setting a trap because he wants him to lead him to Frost.
Right.
And do you want to quote Blade what he says when he gets shot by the police?
Like, what the fuck or something like that? What does he say? Or
something. Oh, he says, motherfucker, are you out of your damn mind?
That's right, motherfucker, you're out of your damn mind. That's right.
that's as great as some motherfuckers always trying to ice skate uphill.
Well, I mean, Wesley really embodied that character, right? And a lot of, like, I think the sense of Blade's personality comes from Wesley's performance.
Right, you know, and if you listen to the commentary, which is, like, some people are watching the movie, and some people, I think, are just reading stuff or whatever for the commentary. It's one of those commentaries that is really all over the place. It's not them actually sitting down and watching the movie together, you know what I mean, commenting on stuff. It's a bunch of different interviews of them watching the movies individually sliced together to a commentary. Wesley talks during it, and he's in his normal voice, and he's not talking like this through his teeth the whole time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was back when the DVD commentaries were like cowboy time, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's some really interesting commentaries from that era because they weren't really managed.
And they're still doing commentaries, by the way. Captain America: New World Order has a commentary on it with the director.
Yeah, they are. They are. I mean, you know, look, I weep for the death of physical media, and the way that like everything would kind of get robust behind the scenes and you could watch your favorite films and learn about filmmaking and storytelling from them. It's so difficult now.
Yeah, totally. Blade almost leaves Karen behind, but then has a flashback to his mother, to his birth. Like, I guess because of his vampire lineage, you know, he can remember the birth, his own birth and his mother dying or not so much dying.
I always took that as the cinematic translation of an instinctual feeling.
Okay, you don't think he's actually remembering his birth because he's got vampire DNA, unlike the rest of us that only really start our memory at the age of three?
No, I think it's cinematic shorthand for, her fear and suffering reminded him of a thing that he had an emotional ghost of, and he made a choice in the moment, like that kind of thing. Because it's not really a puzzle that Blade is consistently trying to solve in the movie. Right, it's not like he goes back and he's constantly trying to work that out. He's not really. So I never really took it as more than the cinematic adaptation of an emotional moment that Blade was having.
True, absolutely. So he looks back at Karen, picks her up, and that's how we end the first 5 minutes that we're covering this film from minutes 10 to 15.
Yeah, really, really. On 15 minutes in, you're pretty much on engine. You know, 15 minutes in, you've got a hero, you know what the hero is fighting. He's then pulled the heroine into the story. You know that she is now aware of what's going on. She will serve as eyes and ears for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You have a strong sense of, like, who the bad guy is, at least in name, with Deacon Frost.
Mm-hmm. And she's a better, like, point of view for the audience than, let's say, another 90s comic book movie, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where we're introduced to Danny, the troubled son of April O'Neil's boss. And it's like, you guys had your own female... You had a human into the Turtles world. You had April.
That's about me. I used to work with Mike Turney.
Really?
Way back in the day, I was doing like scripting for this website called Urban Box Office.
Okay.
And it was a bunch of Flash animated things. I mean, we're going back into the fucking Clone Wars now with me. But this is back in my Clone Wars period when I still had a Jedi braid. Mike Turney was there. And I worked with him for about 3 weeks before I was like, wait a minute, you're Danny from Ninja Turtles. And he was like, yeah, no, he's a really cool guy. I'll be honest, I had the biggest crush on him. What, Judith Hogue?
Yep, she was the original April, yep.
Oh, man, like, you know, the curly hair and the freckles, like, forget about it. Like, I saw that movie a ton of times. But back to Blade.
Yep.
So, and it's just brilliantly constructed, and she's a medical doctor, so she's got, like, a little bit of onboarding into vampirism as a condition and the rest of it. I think that movie is just the template for how you can do something like this. But to your point, right, underlining what you were saying when you were asking me about, like, well, is he remembering his mother? Is he this? Is he that? Nowadays, oh, that's like 3 weeks of studio notes that moment.
Gotcha.
Because that's ambiguity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that gets destroyed is ambiguity. And literally, it would be like 3 weeks of back and forth to figure that out in a script. And then, like, you shot it, you cut it into the movie, more weeks of time discussing it. That's one of the things that we've lost as budgets have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, is the risks are smaller and smaller and smaller.
Mm.
Right? And so, like, a movie like Blade, R-rated, kind of maverickly produced, ultra-violent, it's got expletives all over the place, right? Like, it's just not really an adult horror movie as much as it's just like a mature audience's experience, right? It's like a hip hop album or like a metal album or something, right? It's got a sticker on it, but kids still listen to it. We used to be able to get that energy in theaters a lot. Now we don't really.
Indeed.
Now we don't. So let's say you're Disney.
Brian,
right,
just real quick, we're gonna run out of time on these 5 minutes on the call, so we gotta jump over to the next 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's got the timers counting down to me.
Okay, right on.
Yeah, sorry. I liked what you were saying. It was just we're gonna run out of time.
I didn't even see it.
Brian, why don't you give away where people can find you?
Oh, I mean, I'm sort of on social media.
What you're writing.
Right now I'm writing Ultimate Black Panther for Marvel. I'm on shelves that way. I'm doing a lot of screenwriting these days. Announcements about that would be coming up soon. I directed a film last year called Archangel. It's a horror film. I'm in post on that. There will be updates on when that one's coming out. Image Nation produced that. Same company did Late Night with the Devil, so I'm excited about that. Stars Connor Leslie, friend of mine from Titans. I mean, you can find me on, like, you know, on X, at Brian Edward Hill on X, and then on Instagram, at Brian E. Hill. Although I'm kind of taking a social media detox, so I might not get back to you fast.
Gotcha. And you can find me over on my other shows covering comic books, the Goth Girl Horror, the Hack Slash podcast, where I cover Tim Seeley's Hack Slash, Cassie Hack and Vlad. You can pick up my own vampire book, which is Vlada, A Dracula Tale, where we gender swap the cast of Dracula, and we have a Kickstarter coming up for the upcoming book sequel companion to it, with artwork by Matt Slay and Tim Vigil, Colleen, A Vlada Tale of the Damned, with variant covers by Tim Seeley and multiple other people as well, so hopefully you can check that out. And my regular radio show, Radio Horror, WCUW, every Sunday night, and we'll be back in a couple weeks with another exciting 5 minutes of the original Blade.
Worlds would live.
Worlds would die.
And DC Comics would never be the same again.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The crossover so epic it reached every corner of the DC multiverse. Join DC Dave.
And Doug Adamson as we discuss The Monitor Tapes.
A Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast.
Find us on your favorite podcatcher and join the discussion at themonitortapes.com.